June 11th, 2021. A whole year late. Fireworks above Rome's Stadio Olimpico. Andrea Bocelli singing Nessun Dorma. Fans back in the stadium. Italy against Turkey. And a 3-0 win for the hosts in the opening match of Euro 2020. Comprehensive, like the knowledge of our guest on today's show. From Rome, we have Alistair McKenzie of Reuters News Agency.
I'm Rick Sharma.
And I'm David Gibbs.
And this is Inside the Euros. So Alistair, you were there. 16,000 people in the stadium last night, around 25% of the Olympico's capacity. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty amazing, to be honest. It's been such a long time since we've had anywhere near that size of crowd anywhere in the country. And the atmosphere was absolutely electric. I mean, you mentioned there the opening ceremony a bit, and I arrived at the stadium more than 3 hours before, and even then there were absolutely tons of fans heading up to the stadium, lots of Turkey fans as well, quite a good balance really. And you know, the whole thing, the warm-ups, the atmosphere was incredible when they read out the lineups, and it's got to the point where I can't remember if these things are normal or not, but I think it's one thing kind of getting a big crowd back in the stadium again, but it's another thing when the first game back is your first major tournament home game since 1990 and your first major tournament for 5 years for a country like Italy. I think everyone was just so ready for it by the time it kicked off that it was, honestly, it was a bit of a privilege to be there. It was an amazing night.
Yeah, it looked amazing. Can you see the fireworks? Fireworks are brilliant. I don't even see them from inside the stadium. I found that often to be a problem when you're at a game. You can't actually watch the show.
You could see some. You could see the kind of, I don't know what they're called, those kind of paint ones where they kind of have really kind of concentrated explosion of colour. They were right in front of us. But I don't know about the ones actually above the stadium. I think that was more noise than anything else. I hadn't really thought about that, so you've gone and ruined it for me now.
No, nothing can really replace being there. What was the tournament theme song like with The Edge, Bono and Martin Garrix?
Oh, God. I mean, but look, I don't really have a particularly strong opinion about Bono like a lot of people seem to, but it was the thing that annoyed me more about it was that Bocelli doing Nessun Dorma was genuinely spine-tingling moment. It was incredible performance. Everyone was kind of very moved by it, and the reception to it was incredible. And they went straight from that to Bono. And I feel like if you're going to have to, you know, maybe do something else, like bring out the drummers for a bit or do another kind of bit of your choreography. Give us a few minutes to kind of soak up the Bocelli aftermath before you get into the Bono. That was the only thing that annoyed me about it.
I mean, I've seen Martin Garrix quite a few times doing his sort of club shows and things like that. I think what you need is you do need that like DJ break, which is the changeover where it just gives you that moment to take all in the previous act. And then when the big name, the headliner comes on, it's that explosion, it's the crescendo, everything that goes on there. And I guess it is a bit different because it was like a VT before, so it wasn't actually in the stadium. But it was like the Champions League final with Marshmello. So I guess you wouldn't get the full experience as you normally would, say, with David Guetta, who performed in Paris 4 years ago.
No, and I think this is one of the things that's probably one of the things that's quite like different from being there to watching on TV, because it was really odd in the stadium when the Bono thing happened, because everyone was kind of doing something else at that point. You know, everyone was kind of either talking about the Bocelli thing or going off to get a drink or whatever. It seemed like everyone was kind of distracted because there was nothing on the pitch for the first time in about an hour. And then the song started playing, but to us it sounded like background music, and you had to look up at the screen to kind of see the VR thing you're talking about that everyone else was seeing, because it was just not apparent in the stadium at all. So it was actually kind of the most forgettable moment of the whole thing, probably, because there's nothing to look at.
The last bit of the whole opening ceremony is the ball being delivered for kickoff in a remote control car. Then after that, it was all one-way traffic for Italy in the game itself.
Oh.
That reminds me of sort of days at Murrayfield and at Stade de France in the Six Nations. They bring out the car with the ball, don't they?
Is that have you seen that before, Ali? Is that just like a one-off for the tournament? It's not an Italian thing.
No, it's not Italian. I think it's one of these sponsorship things, isn't it? Is it not like a Hyundai or something very specific tournament sponsor?
Yeah, I think it's Volkswagen.
apologies to UEFA for getting the wrong car sponsor. Yeah, it was a bit bizarre because it felt like such a kind of afterthought after everything else. All this kind of high-tech, amazingly choreographed, well-organized, logistically complicated stuff. Then you just had this kind of remote control car being sent out onto the pitch, and it seemed kind of a bit crap, to be honest. I preferred the moment when Alessandro Totti came on and just booted a ball away. That was fun. That was definitely just a case of, you know, wheeling out the big names for no particular reason, but everyone enjoyed it.
Do you think the ball was sanitised before it came onto the pitch?
Couldn't possibly come in.
Let's get down to the real business, the football. Italy were absolutely fantastic. All the goals came in the second half. Demiralo in goal, forced by Berardi on the right, Ciro Immobile with the second, and Lorenzo Insigne with the third. However, the player that I want to start with, who was my man of the match, was Leonardo Spinazzola. He plays for Roma, he's 28. I've heard very, very little about him over the last few years. He's a left-back, but he's right-footed. He got forward really well. He's like had an all-action performance in that game. What do you make of him, Ali?
I'll be honest, it was a bit of a surprise to see him put in the performance he did and end up winning man of the match, because he's one of the very few, actually, members of this squad who was kind of like fighting for a place. It was pretty well established, I would say, who 8 of the 11 starters would be well in advance. And the only real doubts were whether it be him or Emerson from Chelsea, who's had a lot of games under Mancini. And then between Berardi and Chiesa on the right wing, and then who would play ahead of Verratti while he was injured, which was ended up being Locatelli. But yeah, I mean, that's what Spinazzola does. The thing is, he's been playing as a wing back in a, you know, 3-5-2 or 3-4-1-2 for Roma for the last 2 years. So he's not had an awful lot of time playing as a left back in a back four. But that's his biggest strength, attacking that space. I don't think it was a coincidence to see that the two Rome-based players both performed so well. I was keeping an eye on that. I thought it'd be really interesting to see, because there's home advantage, and then there as a country, and then there's home advantages in these guys playing this on this pitch every week. And there's a lot of attention on Ciro Immobile before this game, whether he could crack it at a major tournament or not. He's been superb for Lazio for 5 years, but in the national team, he still gets a lot of criticism. But, you know, he ended up with a goal and an assist. Spinazzola ends up with Man of the Match award and was absolutely terrorising Turkey down that left. And both of those guys, you know, the two Rome-based players. So I found that quite interesting. But, yeah, and that's what he does best. And obviously Mancini look to kind of find a balance allowing him to do that, and I think it helped that Turkey were sitting so deep in their own half throughout the match that he was really given liberty to do that. You know, it wasn't like they were really risking much on the counter-attack, because Turkey's counter-attacking was awful, so they basically allowed Spinazzola to do what he wanted and play to his strengths as well.
Turkey were awful in general, I thought. It was a dismal start to the competition for them, the fifth consecutive time they've lost an opening Euros match. The coach apologised for the performance after the game. To me, they looked exhausted. Maybe it's that. Maybe just Italy were playing at too high a level. I mean, Mancini's really got them playing, hasn't he? 28 games unbeaten. I mean, this is a statement of intent from Mancini, no? I mean, he's had unfinished business with Italy from his playing days.
Absolutely, yeah. And he was kind of asked about being one of the favourites for the tournament afterwards, and he actually kind of laughed in response. And it's a bit strange, I think, for, you know, those of us who've grown up seeing Italy being a major player at major tournaments, for them to be in a position where the coach finds it laughable for them to be considered favourites, because Italy kind of, you know, historically should be among the favourites. But he is very much trying to relieve the pressure on these players and the team and just have a really relaxed atmosphere. His pre-match press conference was all about, you know, free heads, go out and entertain, put a smile on faces. And obviously it's easy to say that. It's not actually that easy to do that. But you could just tell. I mean, I think they were dominant throughout. They were 14-0 up on attempts at halftime, which is the largest differential in a Euros game since Holland played Latvia in 2004. And as soon as that opening goal went in, I was wondering if that would spark a response from Turkey in some way or a tactical change, but instead it seemed to spark an even greater improvement from Italy, where they just, they finally did relax. You did see that that kind of entertainer's style that Mancini was asking for. And I mean, look, this team is so technically gifted. They really have a lot of quality. So if they are in the right frame of mind and they're confident, they're going to be pretty hard to stop. But yeah, like you say, I think Turkey helped them with their approach and their application.
Do you think Italy, because we haven't seen them at a World Cup, people have slightly forgotten about them? So they're going a bit under the radar. Now this is their chance to prove themselves.
Possibly. I mean, you have to have a pretty short-term memory to forget about Italy. But, I mean, Euro 2016, I guess, was the last time when a lot of people saw them. And they had such a poor squad at that tournament. You know, Italian football wasn't in a brilliant place back then, and the real star of that tournament was Antonio Conte. The fact that he managed to get a team with, you know, Zaza and Graziano Pelle and Giaccherini and all these kind of jokers and take them all the way to knock out Spain. They only went out in the quarterfinals on penalties to Germany, and that was considered a pretty good achievement. So, yeah, then I guess it's the players that people are more familiar with who don't watch Serie A will be, you know, the likes of Jorginho who's playing in the Premier League with Chelsea, or Chiellini, Bonucci, the guys you see in Champions League. There's only seven players in the entire squad who were at Euro 2016, so it's a pretty new look Italy team. There's a lot of young players coming through, exciting new generation coming through. So I think that although people won't have forgotten about Italy as an international force, a lot of people will be quite unfamiliar with this actual Italy squad unless they watch a lot of domestic Italian football.
The squad is much stronger than the Euro 2016 squad, like you say. But as Rio Ferdinand said yesterday, it is a team without a star player. There is no superstar in that team, and maybe that helps them.
Yeah, I mean, when I've been doing preview stuff before the tournament, that's one of the things you always have to write is the key player or the star man. And it's actually, I've always thought with Italy, to be honest, the star man is Mancini. It's similar to 2016 in that way, like what I said with Conte. I think the secret to their success and the greatest asset they've got is Mancini as a manager. And he's one as well, I think, a lot of people might have forgotten about. He's been, you know, in the international kind of side of things, doing his business quietly for the last 3 years. But he has a brilliant track record and has really transformed the national team from, you know, when they lost that playoff to Sweden, it was a complete tragedy for the country. It was a real time of, I guess, kind of self-analysis, self-loathing, and working out what the hell's going wrong with Italian football. And for him to bring, he's given so many caps to new players. I can't remember the number now, but so many players have been taken into the team under Mancini. Even for the Euros, you know, Giacomo Raspadori, who's a 21-year-old Sassuolo striker who's came into form towards the end of the season, he ends up in the squad having never earned a cap before. He only earned his first cap in the final warm-up game. So he's really willing to take a chance on these younger guys. You didn't see too many of them last night, but they are there. Yeah, I think the future is pretty bright, to be honest. Even if Italy don't make it all the way in to win the tournament this summer, I think that they're definitely set down the path to retaking their place as a major international force again with the kind of group of players they've got.
One of the players that we picked out ahead of the tournament, and despite the fact there is no kind of star player, like everyone says, is Barella, who was good in my eyes yesterday. I don't know what you made of his performance. He was in our predicted team of the tournament for the podcast.
Yeah, he was okay. I mean, I kind of, in the first half especially, wanted a bit more from him. He does tend to be the one, you know, in that midfield three, the one who's given more license to bomb on, because Jorginho kind of anchors that midfield and, you know, does his metronome thing that he's done throughout his career. And Locatelli is actually usually does a similar thing to Jorginho, but was asked to do something slightly different yesterday. I thought that Barella perhaps could have, you know, done a bit more between the lines to stretch the Turkish defence for me in the first half. But yeah, I mean, look, he's brilliant. He's come on leaps and bounds under Conte into the last couple of years and is really one of the pin-up stars of that new generation, along with Locatelli, has to be said. And yeah, you know, then you've got the likes of Chiesa coming off the bench, who didn't really get much of a chance to do an awful lot yesterday, but is another really exciting young player.
On Chiesa.
And they've still got Marco Verratti to come back. You know, Verratti is their star player, I would say. You know, when Verratti is at his best, he is, for me, probably the best central midfielder in European football. But he's so rarely fully fit at the moment, it seems. But he can do everything, really. And when he's in that midfield with Jorginho and Barella, it becomes even more impossible to take the ball off them. And he's kind of fighting to be back for the Swiss game on Wednesday. I'd be kind of surprised if he starts, to be honest, and that if they risk him, especially now that they've got such a good opening day result. But don't forget about Verratti. He's still a big name to come back into that.
It would be a shame for Locatelli if he had to drop out after that performance yesterday. Some really nice passing in midfield. You mentioned Chiesa. It looks bad for him, doesn't it? Because Berardi was really good on the right-hand side, and he set up the opening goal with that cross that hit Demiral and went in, and he had a really bright second half, Berardi.
Yeah, and look, I have to say, we don't have to talk about this, but I just have to point out that it is incredible to have two Sassuolo players in the starting 11 of Italy's first major tournament in five years, and they are two of the best performers on the pitch, and Locatelli and Berardi. This is such a small provincial club that's climbed up from the third division into Serie A, and now is producing players like this, but... well, not producing them necessarily, but at least grooming them. But yeah, no, you're right. Berardi is, like I said at the start, he was one of the kind of the ones who still had to earn his place, really, over Chiesa. And I think Mancini likes the balance of having him a left foot, you know, kind of left, cutting in on his left foot from the right wing, and Insigne doing vice versa on the left wing. But yeah, he put in a really good performance, really impressed with him. And, yeah, made himself undroppable, I would say. I think Chiesa's going to find... Chiesa's a great bench player, though. I mean, this is the thing. With five subs at this tournament, it's crazy amount of options for a manager to have. And Chiesa is so quick and skillful. He can really stretch defences later on in games. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them stick to that formula swapping the two of them kind of for the final half hour or so.
Lastly, for me, just something on the covering the game. What was it like to be covering a match in the Euros, in the COVID era, with press conferences on Zoom, obviously much more distance than you're expecting between yourself and the players, for example, in a mixed zone, which obviously doesn't take place anymore?
The thing is, it's the first major tournament I'm covering, so I don't really have anything to compare it to, but it's kind of, yeah, we've got kind of used to it, I guess, from the last year and a half or so of covering domestic football, and it's a similar kind of idea. All the press conferences over Zoom, like you say, with kind of feedback coming off everyone's microphones and people not working out how to do it properly still. And yeah, it's very well organized. I'll say that they've really put together a very kind of smooth, well-drilled operation for the tournament in Rome. It is a shame it's not like the good old days, and there isn't the full access and the full crowd and the rest of it, but it still feels like an absolutely massive step forward compared to where we've been for the last year and a half.
That's great, Ali. Thank you very much. Looking forward to today's action. First up is Wales against Switzerland in Baku. Later on, we've got Denmark against Finland and Belgium versus Russia. On paper, two easy wins, those, for Denmark and Belgium, but Kevin De Bruyne won't play in St. Petersburg, while Axel Witsel is also still out. Both remained in Belgium, didn't make the trip. And with Russia at home, let's see if they can spring a surprise. For more info and analysis on Group B, check out our preview pod with Christophe Terreur, going into great detail on Belgium and Eden Hazard and all of that. And that's all for today. We'll be back on Monday morning after those games, as well as England-Croatia, Austria-North Macedonia, and the Netherlands against Ukraine. Ciao for now.